Welcome to Spark Your Fire Podcast. Content discussed on this podcast is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals. Now, let's start with the quote of the week.
By far the best investment you can make is in yourself. If you invest in yourself, nobody can take it away from you. You know, the most important thing is really who you associate with. You want to associate with people that are better than you are. I mean, basically, you'll go in the direction of the people that you associate with.
G'day, everyone. Welcome back to another Friday News Wrap. David Shee here. I've been missing in action last week, and I know these two gentlemen have been talking behind my back. I've been tuning in every episode afterwards. just joking. You guys have been doing a fantastic job, Jazz. And look, I think John's not here with us today. For some reason, he's actually having a long weekend.
I thought we kicked him out.
Well, come on, we got to say it nicely, right? Because he's going to listen to this episode as well. I think the main news this week is all about budgets, Jazz, really, isn't it? So I think if you tune in every media channel, it's all about budget 2020. And there's various aspects of things that we can talk about, but I think we just want to focus on what's relevant for investors. The few points that I've had here that are really related to individuals are mostly the tax cuts, which stage two tax cut is now being brought forward, okay, and it's going to be backdated from 1st of July 2020. So beforehand, I think it was 2022 was the original date,
yeah, or something correct, like correct.
That. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now they've obviously brought that forward, and that basically, just put it into perspective, puts about $12 billion into the pockets of Australians. That's a lot of money, mm-hmm. putting basically governments giving back to the, in a different format, not printing money, but basically giving back. So that hoping they're going to, you know, take it out of the pocket and spend it, because spending mm-hmm. is what we all need at the moment, right?
Yeah.
So, so the individuals, and so stage two tax cuts essentially comes down to having a 19, so they brought the 19% tax bracket to increase from $37,000 mm-hmm. to $45,000, okay? So anyone who's earning an income from $37,000 or below, currently enjoying 90% tax bracket, that's going to increase to 45. So in other words, you can earn up to 45K and still only pay up to 19% tax bracket between, I think it was 18,000 to about 45,000. Okay. So mm-hmm. that's the bracket that you only need to pay 90%. The rest you pocket yourself. And then for the kind of the medium income earners, it's 90 grand to 120 grand. So that's, sorry, let me rephrase again. 32.5% bracket will rise from 90 grand to 120 grand annual income. So if you're currently earning $90,000 or over $90,000, you'll be relieved all the way up to about $120,000, where beforehand you'd be paying up to about 37 or even 40%. Now you only need to pay 32.5% as long as you earn less than 120K per annum.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's putting a lot of people, putting money back into a lot of people's pocket. And the last segment for the stage two income tax cut is the 45% income tax bracket will rise from 180K to 200K. So if you're currently earning 180 or just below 200, you'll be pleased to know that you won't be making that you won't be making that much payment mm-hmm. again. So yeah, it's essentially giving money back to taxpayers, hoping that they'll be able to spend on the economy, and that's exactly what we need right now. What do you reckon, Jazz?
Great, David. You mentioned the figures. I think what it's telling us basically is that politicians or the government is basically trying to put the money back into the hands of the consumers.
Absolutely.
To hit the inflation targets and obviously keep the economy churning, which is the velocity of money, with the amount of money that was being sucked out of the economy due to fear and all the job losses and other stuff would have had obviously some impact.
Yeah.
But the big I think the big theme here is essentially they want to meet the inflation targets. And one way to meet the inflation target, which I think was about, 2.2% from the chart that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, thereabouts. And this is one way to hit your inflation target along with all the other things that they will be doing, which is fiscal stimulus and all that stuff. But this will obviously give a great deal of support to the retailers and all the businesses out there to some extent.
That's exactly what we need right now, right? Those businesses are desperate for, obviously, consumer spending. And in order to hit the inflation target, as you said, that's exactly what they need. Essentially, it's more like a wealth effect. I think that's exactly what they're trying to do here. They're trying to basically make people feeling that they've got more money in the pocket, you know, whether that's through property, which we'll touch on a little bit later, and or the other way, you know, by giving tax cuts, all of a sudden you've got a lump sum coming back. You feel like, oh, I've actually got more money back this financial year. I'm before to spend a bit more. So that kind of wealth effect or that mentality will allow people to spend a lot more rather than in a contractual type of mindset where, you know, like in back in COVID, right? In the middle of COVID, it's no one's wanting to spend. Everyone's basically holding back on spending completely. So
exactly, especially, and this is one of the things that we've discussed in the past as well, that there, due to COVID, there will be obviously restrictions on the restaurants, retailers out there that they can have limited number of people within their space. And with that comes is their revenues will obviously drop a bit. So the more you can, which means they will probably try and increase the prices of the goods to some extent. And the only way you can support that part of it is, again, if you put the money back into the consumer's pocket. And the one way to put the money back into the consumer's pocket is the tax cuts. So great. I think it's a great move.
Now, the other one that I think is worth mentioning is for granny flat owners, they are scraping the capital gains tax for granny flats. So again, you know, that's more relevant for investors who's got granny flat. Obviously, if they're selling, then in the past, they will incur capital gains tax on that. But as part of this budget, that's the capital gains tax will now be waived for granny flats. So definitely good news for investors to that degree, which means, you know, if they're realizing profits, then they can actually pocket a lot more in their own pockets in that sense. So again, that's another good win for investors. The other one I have is the first home buyer scheme, which I think we've it was brand new release earlier this week. I can't remember exactly when it was, but 10,000 another additional 10,000 spot has been released for first home loan deposit scheme. So for those of us for those of you who are not being up to date with this, the first home loan deposit scheme allows first home buyers to get into the market with as little as 5% deposit. Okay, so and basically government acts as the guarantee or the guarantor for to waive the LMI, so the lender mortgage insurance, which typically you have to pay for anything that you lend over 80%. Yeah, so essentially the lender mortgage insurance is waived to that extent, and you can purchase your property for as little as just 5% using government as the guarantee. So the first 10,000 spots obviously gone very, very quickly since the initial release of 1st of July 2020. So since then, they've decided to, as part of the economy stimulus, they want to stimulate more first home buyers to be able to purchase their first home. So they are now releasing another 10,000 spots. However, there's a cap. There's a caveat to it. Beforehand, the first home loan deposit scheme applies to all type of property, whether it's existing or new. But this time, the additional 10,000 can only be used to build a new home or buy a newly built home. Okay, so there's a difference here. So for those of people who are looking at purchasing existing properties, unfortunately, this additional 10,000 spots will not be applied, will not be applicable to you. So, you know, I think the government's intention is pretty clear here. They want to make sure that the new housing market, the brand new housing markets, are still being supported, because as we know that all that crappy news about building quality, et cetera, is making first home owners and first home buyers try to steer away from those brand new buildings. So, you know, the brand new building industries are obviously taking a hit. So right now, they're basically incentivizing people to look at purchasing or constructing brand new properties. And if you do so, then you will be eligible to take up one of the 10,000 additional spots that's been released.
It's really good, actually, David, that the government is supporting both the construction activity and the first home buyers activity at the same time, as much as they can, except that we have scrapped the responsible lending rules. So yeah, as long as first home buyers are the most vulnerable ones, so as long as they are not over leveraging, I think it's a great move.
Correct.
And plus the chart that we had over there, David, which clearly shows that the owner occupier activity is, which is the green line through 2020, has taken a turn and it's moving upwards. And investor sentiment is still a bit tight, but clearly first home buyers or the owner occupiers essentially are leading the charge compared to the investors to some extent.
Yeah, that's right. So the investors charts are now basically falling. So this relates to the growth in housing related debt. The owner occupiers, which is related to the green line, is hovering around the 5%. In other words, they're doing like an annual 5% change, whereas the investors are going now into negative. However, the trend for both lines are actually turning. They're turning towards the positive side of things. Mm-hmm. So that's the key message here, which is what, Jazz, I think you're trying to illustrate. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely a positive news. Now, just on the first home loan deposit scheme as well, I just want to point out that this additional $10,000, the purchase cap has also been lifted from $750,000 to $950,000. They know it's a lot more expensive for brand new properties, so therefore the purchasing cap has also been lifted to basically on for that. But as just pointed out numerous times, just because you can doesn't mean that you should.
Yes.
So, you know, again, make sure that you can afford it. And it's a very, you know, Jazz and I cannot stress more than enough, as we're both mortgage brokers, you know, if you're going to be struggling to be able to borrow up to 95%, then you should not. You should be looking at something more cheaper that's affordable to you. So, you know, we do not want to see out of this anyone putting into hardship, especially with the record low interest rate, right? That we don't know when it's going to, at some point it's going to go back up. So, you know, you've got to safeguard yourself by thinking longer term. So while it's a great time to get in, be a bit cautious about what you can afford and consider from all aspects.
And the other chart that was feeding into the same chart that we discussed just before, which is the owner-occupier activity strengthening, is this chart. This chart has been posted by IFM Investors. And David, again, new housing finance, we can clearly see a strong uptick over there month on month.
Mm-hmm.
It's up by about 13.6%. Year by year, year on year, it's up by about almost 30%. So strong owner-occupier activity and all the things that we just mentioned around the first homeowner's grant and all that stuff, all of that low interest rate environment, all of that is feeding into it.
Yep.
And again, on the same chart of IFM Investors, we can see the investor activity is good, but it's not as good as compared to the owner-occupiers, which is investor activity month on month is up by about 9.3%, but year on year, it's still down by minus 4.6%. But the key point here is that the negative slope is turning into a positive slope now, which has to be watched over the next couple of months, I think.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, I think it's the trend that we're seeing here. It certainly started to turn around. So, you know, I think maybe looking in a few months' time, I know John made the call. He always says, you know, he's the first one to make the call. I reckon he might have called it around the bottom, around close to the right time. So we'll see in the next few weeks.
John is the real predictor.
That's right. We keep pushing him to make predictions every episode, right? That's part of the fun too. Okay, so a couple of fast facts about the budget 2020. Mm-hmm. So $213.7 billion going to be the deficit. Okay, so that's where we're going to be heading into, with a gross debt to hit $1 trillion next year. I'm starting to lose count of all these zeros, to be honest, Jack. but it seems like trillion is going to be the new currency or the new norm.
Yeah, we throw trillion around as if it's a few thousand, obviously.
and the goal out of the budget 2020 is to have unemployment to be lower by 8% or up to a maximum 8% by December. Okay, so drop the unemployment down to 8%. and 11.6 million people to get a tax cut with stage two cuts to be backdated to July 1st. So just like what we've covered comprehensively, basically it's about putting money into people's pocket and also creating jobs. So, you know, they obviously got different incentives for employing people, what they defined as young people up to 34, 35 years old, I think it was. I've just missed the mark. So I feel I'm actually on the other side of the bandwagon now, getting the other end of the stick, but I'm not going to hold it personally. So their target is have nearly 1 million jobs to be created out of this budget 2020. So it's all about jobs, employment, money back in people's pocket for spending.
Exactly. And I think RBI Governor Phil Lowe has been pretty vocal about the debt, that it's not the time to be worried about debt too much. It's important, but right now it's more important to get the economy back on its feet.
Correct.
This fast facts that you have just mentioned, David, clearly tell that they're less worried about the debt and more worried about getting the economy back on the rails as soon as possible. And then they'll look back at the debt and try and figure out what to do with it, basically.
Exactly.
It's a concern, but it's a second concern right now rather than the primary concern. So,
and I think actually while you touch on the RBA governor, Philip Lowe, it's also worth mentioning that RBA has decided to keep the cash rate to remain the same for October. So they just, because it was the same day as the budget announcement. So I think RBA decided not to take the spotlight off the budget 2020. So it was pretty discreet, but they didn't drop, which, you know, a lot of people were, or a lot of economists were anticipating, they may be dropping it down to 0.1%, the cash rate down to 0.1%, but it didn't happen this month. Who knows for Melbourne? On the Melbourne Cup Day, maybe that's when in November. Maybe that's when they drop. What do you reckon, Jess?
I think it's not off the tables off the table yet, David. Just like what you mentioned just before, I think there's a high probability that it can still happen next month. And the reason for that is not really, like we said last time, it's not really to stimulate the property market or anything. It's more the currency that. Yep. And plus the cheap funding for the banks. So they are the two main reasons. As you were mentioning it, I just quickly looked at the two-year bonds.
Yep.
And it's still priced in into the two-year bond from what I can tell.
So is it still 0.1? Or?
Yeah, 0.142.
Wow. So it's already been priced in the bonds
exactly.
market.
So unless we see an uptick in the yield over here, I think there's a high probability that it can still happen next month. Remember, the resource sector is doing really well up in Perth, and we did cover on that last week with David while covering the property market.
Yep.
And that can create some tailwinds for Aussie dollar. And if that happens, then it's something that RBA will be forced to do.
All right. What else have we got?
Other big piece, yep. And we've covered that a lot already, David, is mainly just the article that was posted by Terry Ryder, founder of hotspotting.com.au. And what he is mentioning in the article is pretty much what we said in the last few weeks, is essentially Australia is on the cusp of a national real estate boom. Now, he's used the word national over there, which means that this time what he's saying is that we'll see it across the board, especially in the regional areas. And we have touched on the regional areas as well with Simon Presley in the past.
Thanks to Simon giving us a very detailed episode. You know, we did run through the Australia like a bit of a virtual tour. So it was a great episode for those who haven't actually caught up yet. Definitely go back a few weeks back and catch up on that episode. But yeah, I tend to agree that I reckon we might have just, as I said earlier, we might have just seen the rebound at the moment. And you know, looking back, and we don't know, maybe a year later, we might look back and say, you know, September, October 2020 was actually around the time before the rebound. You know, that was bottom of the market at that time for national. And as we can see from the trend as well, you know, Adelaide, Perth, Brisbane already started leading in terms of that trend. They're already positive figures at the moment. Sydney from last month, I think it was minus 0.4. Victoria need a bit of catch up, but obviously with stage four easing, hopefully in the next few weeks, then that figure, I think, will definitely rebound strongly as well, because that pent-up demand is going to come out all one go. So yeah, I reckon it's pretty bullish in terms of the property front. The only uncertainty, I think, when you and I do agree, and I'm sure John would as well if he's here, is we're still yet to see what's going to happen with the JobKeeper, job seeker being basically reduced. What the real impact of that is. Mm-hmm. Yes, the budget 2020 is obviously addressing, you know, and trying to help in a separate form to be able to get Australia going. But at the same time, rather than directly pumping money to people via JobSeeker, JobKeeper, at the moment they shift the focus. They shift the focus to actually getting businesses, you know, like the incentivizing businesses. And it's all about to do, you know, businesses. If the businesses are hiring people that's under 35, yes, we're giving you money to be able to help with hiring. For those first home owners, if you're taking action, if you're buying brand new properties, then we are helping you with first home loan deposit scheme. It's all about taking actions now. Mm-hmm. So there's a shift of paradigm here. You know, whereas beforehand, JobKeeper, JobSeeker, it's like, okay, yes, we can try. But at the end of the day, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't hit, we still get the money. But now, there's a slight difference shifting from the JobKeeper, JobSeeker to budget 2020.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an important point. That caveat hasn't been removed yet. The caveat is still there.
Yeah.
And when that happens, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, totally.
But I think there's enough stimulus being provided to prop up some new businesses and support the existing ones. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty fair to say that. So, David, we're done with our weekly wrap. Now we've got our special guest, which we absolutely adore whenever she's on our podcast, Melinda from Queensland. Melinda, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks, Jazz. Thanks for the intro. That was very kind of you.
we were missing you for when did we last have Melinda, David? Now it's been a few months.
April, I'd say probably a good 6 months, to be honest. And yeah, a lot of listeners will be curious about what's happening in Queensland, that's for sure.
Yeah. So, Melinda, just quickly, we had David on our podcast last week from Perth to give us to give us the Perth property market update. And there's a lot of activity happening in the resources area. And Queensland is to some extent tied to resources along with all the other sectors. Just wanted to have your take on the markets currently. What's happening from a buyer's perspective, and what are you guys seeing on the ground?
It has certainly been an interesting time, and over the last few months since we've had our last chat, the markets actually continued to track sideways, and in fact, in a lot of areas, it has started to grow in value. Now, there's been a lot of changes in that time as well. Obviously, we've had the border closures. That's been quite significant because it's impacted on the rate of population growth that we experience. However, population itself only, you know, makes up one part of the demand equation. And what we found, regardless of, you know, interstate migration falling away, as well as international migration falling away, is that local demand has been really strong. So I would say, 85, 90% of buyers have been home buyers in Brisbane. And the different market segments have all been supported by people that are looking to upgrade, that do have security of income and that do have access to finance. And right now it's never been cheaper to borrow money. So they seem to be the segment of the market that are driving the market, and certainly in the pockets that are very desirable pockets in Brisbane, we've seen price escalation.
Investor sentiment is still low, fair to say, up in Queensland?
I would say that's starting to shift very quickly as consumer sentiment, or as the news becomes more positive. We saw the Westpac CEO put out some quite optimistic forecasts, especially for Brisbane between 2022 and 2023. It's amazing how much that can change consumer sentiment. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, from our own business, the inquiry has literally picked up in the last 2 or 3 weeks, potentially off the back of some of that more positive sentiment coming through. So, that said, there's still a lot of people that assume or think that you can negotiate a very big discount on asking prices off the back of the fact that there's people in financial distress because of the pandemic. That's not happening in Brisbane. It's certainly not happening in any of the locations that we've been actively buying, because there's far too many buyers for the number of properties that become available. So you can't negotiate a discount when there's 10 buyers negotiating on one property because supply and demand is out of balance in that instance. So yeah, it's been an interesting trend, and that's why we're seeing that upward pressure on price.
I was speaking to one of the lending specialists, one of the bank BDMs, and they up in Queensland, and they talked about how much lending they're doing for some of the, especially for the Victorian buyers. Are you guys seeing any of that activity or none of that?
Absolutely. We're hearing through our industry colleagues that a lot of interstate buyers are purchasing in Brisbane sight unseen. Now, there's obviously risk associated with that, but it helps you to understand who the buyers are and what their motivations are. So, yes, Melbourne buyers, especially at the top end of the market, have been very active purchasing homes, you know, and we're talking at price points above the $2 million mark in this instance. And, in fact, I was a part of an online seminar yesterday, which just reconfirmed that expats and, you know, interstate buyers are really driving the top end of our market. But that said, we're starting now to see the interstate investors return to the market and, you know, driven by the yields that Brisbane can provide and also the prospects for future capital growth, which we just haven't had the great fundamentals in place until now for some strong growth in the years ahead.
Right. Okay. Now you're a numbers girl. Any numbers that you want to talk about?
Where do you want to start? Look, I think the good place to start is what's happening in the land market, because off the back of some of the home builder incentives that the government have put through, we've certainly seen a huge demand, particularly from first home buyers in vacant land. So we can look at the quarterly and annual change in the different regions. Of interest is that the Moreton Bay region has seen a huge spike in the value of vacant land over the last 12 months. And this data is taken from CoreLogic, Queensland Market Monitor report that the REIQ put out. So we've seen a spike of 6.1% over the last 12 months in Moreton Bay vacant land sales, and over the last quarter of 1.9%. That's the region that's seen the greatest increase. Compare that with Redlands, which is another region which has had a decline of 14.3% over the last 12 months in vacant land values, and the quarterly change, negative 10.4%. So you can see that Brisbane's not one property market, and in fact what I always say is you're not buying into a city, you're buying into a suburb. So even when we're talking about regions, we need to be mindful that not all suburbs within a region will perform in the same way. So that gives you an indication of where people are buying vacant land. Then we can look at houses and units. Now, house values in Brisbane, in the Brisbane local government area, we've seen an annual change of 2.9%, but just in the last quarter, an increase of 0.7% in house sales. Moreton Bay region has been fairly flat in the last quarter, but we've seen an increase of 0.9% in house values over the last 12 months. The Ipswich region, flat in the last quarter, a flat annual change, so no change across either the quarterly or 12-month figures there. Logan has seen an increase of 0.9% in the last quarter and an annual change of 1.3%. So that's been good for people that have got into that area. Redlands, again, an underperformer, negative 1% change for houses for the quarter and an annual change of negative 1.9% as well. So it just gives you an indication of you know, how different regions are performing. But as I mentioned, it's really important to understand what's happening at a suburb level, because not all suburbs within a region will be performing in the same way.
Interesting. No one's got a crystal ball again, and this is not a financial advice, but I think your predictions from memory was roughly about 15-20% uptick in the prices over the next 2 to 3 years from memory. I could be wrong. Are we still holding on to that?
Yeah, look, I was... the Brisbane market has been strong. We never changed what we were saying even throughout the worst of the pandemic based on what we were seeing on the ground. We really felt that the buyer demand was too strong to see any price values fall. That's now been proven in the data, and, you know, we haven't seen price falls throughout Brisbane, throughout any of the regions except the Redlands, as I've just pointed out in that data. But looking forward, you know, just based on the fundamentals, the number of buyers that we're seeing out on weekends at open homes, the number of buyers that are putting forward offers on individual properties, I don't think that we've had any opportunity to negotiate a property that's been listed on the market that has not been a multiple offer situation. So That gives you an indication of buyer demand. Now, we are not active throughout all of Greater Brisbane, but we are very active throughout the Brisbane local government area, as well as certain pockets within Moreton Bay, and it is across the board. That's what we're seeing. But it is off the back of much lower listing volumes. Over the last 12 months, we've seen listings decline in Brisbane by 10.4%, in Moreton by 7.2%. Ipswich, it's down 13.3%, and Logan, it's down 13.3% as well, and a decline in Redlands, 11.3%. So there's fewer properties to buy, and if I'm comparing the number of buyers that were out looking for property 12 months ago versus today, there's definitely been a significant uptick in that time, despite the worst of the pandemic.
Sweet, that's awesome. Anything else that you want to add?
Look, I think that, you know, I just urge investors to have a look at vacancy rates of regions as well, particularly if they're interested to understand what the potential rental return will be, because your net gross or your net yields will be dependent on how many weeks in a year your property is vacant. We've had some vacancy risk in the inner city market, particularly in the higher density units. At the peak of the pandemic, it was 14% vacancy. So that's a significant risk if you are an investor in that space. That has subsequently declined. We're now at around 7.9% in that market, but that still poses as a vacancy risk. Most of the other regions around the Brisbane local government area and Moreton Bay, Ipswich, Logan and Redlands have very low vacancy. In fact, vacancies are still trending downwards. And when we look at a suburb level, there are some suburbs with vacancy rates around 0.5% right now. So properties that we've purchased that we are listing for rent, there are multiple tenants putting in applications and people are actually applying at a higher level than advertised. So we're certainly going to see some evidence of rental price growth in some regions in the future off the back of very low supply of rental properties as well.
Nice. That's really good.
Melinda, why do you think Redland is the only one that's trending down at the moment? Do you have any insights on that?
It's an interesting question, but there's been a lot of redevelopment of land in Redlands. Sometimes, you know, median values can be a little bit misleading as well.
Yeah,
because what's potentially happened is that the size of that land has shrunk significantly compared to previous sales. So,
okay.
You know, investors do need to be aware and they need to understand what makes up the data. I'm a big believer in you cannot rely purely on numbers. You have to understand what makes those numbers up.
Mm-hmm.
But even established housing has declined in that location, but that's potentially off the back of the supply that's been, you know, new developments happening in the area.
Okay.
Just one last question, Melinda, that I have was, we're seeing resource sector to be performing really well over the next few years for Australia. That's iron, gold, and other minings, basically, rare earth metals. And because Queensland is, to some extent, part of that story. Do you see, and they are boom and bust towns as well, but do you see, based on that, some of the areas with decent infrastructure, which are closer to the mining proximity outperforming the others?
It's a good question. I don't typically study other markets to understand what the supply side of the equation looks like because property values are driven by the balance between the supply of available properties and new dwellings and overlaid with the demand for those properties. And when you do have a boom in the resources sector, it certainly does improve or increase demand for properties in select locations throughout the state, including Brisbane, because a lot of the larger companies actually have, you know, offices and head offices and a lot of staff are based in the capital. So without understanding the supply side dynamics, I believe there could be an improvement in the demand for properties in some of those locations, but I urge investors to also study the supply side and understand what are the listing volumes like in that area and what is the potential for new supply like in that area before they make an investment decision on location.
Awesome. Great. That's a great wrap, Melinda. Thanks for your update. We'd love to bring you back at some point in the future as the market improves over the next couple of months and this whole 2020 is over, tired of it.
We're all a bit tired of being locked up at home. I mean, we're very lucky up here in Brisbane, admittedly. We have very few restrictions in place, and they are easing every day simply because of a lack of community transmission. So we are lucky and we are thankful, but we do think a lot about what's happening down south and what has been happening. So
it's
time to move north.
You bet. Melinda will be the first person I'll be calling to find me a house up there.
Nothing less than $5 million, just so you know.
Like a healthy budget.
Awesome. Thanks for that, Melinda. We'll catch soon again. I appreciate
you're
your
welcome
time.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Cheers.
Bye.
That was a good wrap from Melinda overall, which is good. Ties back to the story that we.
I think it's great. Clear, concise bit of data. So the data reflects what's really happening on the ground, basically. Even though the data is usually a bit of a lagging indicator. So you know, we were looking at retrospective data back in August. But that certainly proves the sentiment that's currently on the ground. There's still multiple offers going on, and there's a lot of demand that outweighs supply. So, yeah.
Awesome. Anything else that we want to add for listeners, David, before we wrap this up?
No, I think we've covered pretty much the key aspects of this week. It's a shame that John couldn't join us, as always. But look, you know, we'll give him a hard time next week when he's back. Get him an opportunity to talk about his thoughts on budget 2020. I'm sure he's got lots to add. but yeah, it's been as we said, you know, offline that it's been quite interesting 2020. Never a dull moment and never a dull week, is it?
Never, ever. And next week, what we'll do is, David, we'll put ourselves on mute and let just John talk and see how
Good experiment.
Awesome. Listeners, happy weekend. And we'll see you guys next week with our weekly wrap. Play safe, stay safe. Cheers.
Cheers.